Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am reluctantly, sadly, unfortunately, still recording from home with my home microphone, my home recording equipment, and my home kids who are running around outside my door. I don't enjoy it, but it's for the best that I can still do this and stay safe, hopefully. Joining me is another entrepreneur who's recording from home, who's a little bit happier about getting to do that. He is a guy, Jan Pritzker, who created a site to help musicians sell their equipment. And if you were to come to me and say, musicians get to help sell their equipment back when he launched the company, I would have probably said, you know, there's eBay already. What do we need another website for selling equipment? There's Craigslist. There's this, there's that. But he got into it and he got excited about it and he built it up and he eventually sold it to Etsy, another marketplace that also would have maybe seemed to not make sense in a world with all these other marketplaces, but boy, it's done really well. I invited him here to talk about Reverb, the marketplace for new and used musical instruments that he helped grow and he profited from a sale. Can I say that? That's a little bit.
Sure.
It's a little crass, Jan, for me to have said that. So, but he did. He did do well with that company. I invited him here to talk about that and to find out why he's getting into Bitcoin next. Does the world need another Bitcoin website to help you buy and sell Bitcoin? He says yes. He created Swan Bitcoin. The thing that makes them interesting is Swan lets you connect your bank account to your account with Swan, and then it automatically will let you buy Bitcoin from, what is it, month to month, week to week?
Week to week, monthly, paycheck, whatever you prefer.
And it automatically does that. Mm-hmm. All right, this interview where we find out about how Jan keeps coming up with these companies that other people had already come up with ideas for and still manages to do well is sponsored by two phenomenal sponsors. The first will help you build landing pages and funnels and get more strangers to become your customers. It's called ClickFunnels. Check them out at clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. And the second, if you're finally building a website or deciding that you want to move your hosting company to a cheaper, people hate when I say cheaper, less expensive one that's still really good, hostgator.com/Mixergy. I'll talk about those later. Jan, how much did you guys sell Reverb for?
275 million. Although to be fair, I actually left the company about a year prior to the sale. So I'm not going to take credit for the sale. I will, however, take credit for building the company to where it was on the tech side and very excited about that and very proud of the team there.
275 to Etsy in cash?
Correct.
How much did you own at the end of that? Let's be open.
I'd rather not
say. Give me a ballpark. Over 10%?
A little bit less than that.
A little bit less than 10%.
Yeah. When I left Reverb, the company was able to buy back some of my shares. So I ended up with a smaller chunk at the point of sale than I would have otherwise had if I had stayed on.
Were you happy about them buying you out? Did you feel frustrated and acceptance or what?
You know, I was happy because it was immediate cash liquidity for me. And, you know, I'm not a greedy person. It wasn't like an insignificant amount of money. It could have been more, but you know, it was plenty of money for me to go ahead and start my own business and work on my own thing. And that's really what my passion at the end of my Reverb tenure started kind of drifting towards Bitcoin. And I felt like I had to leave and work on that. And I didn't even, you know, think about the buyout, really. I was just going to do it anyway. But because the buyout happened, it just made it so much easier for me to go ahead and do that.
Did you do anything for yourself? Any personal stuff? Did you take a trip before we all went into lockdown? Did you buy anything nice for yourself?
You know, we bought a house, so okay, I guess that's nice. Great. Yeah, we were living in a relatively small house and, you know, it was getting cramped with the two kids. So I was able to buy a house. Actually, you know, probably I wouldn't have been able to get this house otherwise, because it was a bidding war. It's a neighborhood here in Chicago where there's like five or six bids per house at any time it goes on sale. So it was very tough to get this house, but I'm very happy in it. And
what's the one thing that you especially love about the house? When you saw it, you said, this is the place for me.
It's just, you know, I'm a huge fan of mid-century modern architecture, and I love really open spaces, lots of glass. You could see behind me that whole glass wall behind me, but that's just a small piece of it. The whole house is like this. And I love living in a transparent house where you can see everything. I love my kids run in the yard and watch them from any point in the house. So that's kind of my dream.
And you do okay with your kids working, with you working out of the house and your kids being in the house?
Well, they're, you know, my grandparents are helping, or my parents rather, their grandparents are helping quite a bit. So they're gone a large part of the day. But I like spending time with my kids. You know, I try not to get frustrated with them as they're running around and making lots of noise while I'm trying to work. That's obviously tough. But I also enjoy spending time with them and teaching them things. And, you know, we're kind of homeschooling now with this whole new lockdown situation. So that's new for us. And we're learning what works and what doesn't.
I think I'm going to build a shed in the backyard or some quiet studio in the backyard just in case this goes on longer than I expected.
Yeah, well, we're preparing. I mean, we're actually building a playground in the back. We've got them. We built a geodesic dome, and now we're building. We just bought a inflatable swimming pool, getting prepared for not being able to go to the pool in the summer. So, and my parents have just created an amazing playground for my children. It's just, you know,
in the backyard or at their place?
Yeah, their backyard. They took out half of their backyard, covered it with, you know, wood chips, and built like a legit playground with slides, like swings, everything. So,
look at you. Your parents, I keep thinking about how they came from the Soviet Union, right?
Yes, they did.
What was it like growing up in the Soviet Union?
You know, for me, I was 7 years old when I left. So a lot of what I remember is kind of bits and pieces. And I didn't really know how bad it was until we got here. You know, we had shortages of goods. We had to stand in line for things. We lived in essentially a one or two bedroom apartment. Really, it was a one bedroom apartment for four of us. You know, our kitchen was like, I don't know, 5 by 5 feet or something like that. So these kinds of conditions were normal in the Soviet Union. So it's very hard to tell because you didn't have any exposure to outside media, you know, information. Nobody knew what life outside was like. And so when immigrants came to America, a lot of times you hear the stories of, you know, what do you first remember about America? Everybody remembers their first grocery store. They remember going into like an Aldi where, you know, it's like a very low level grocery store, but it's 10 times the abundance of anything in Russia. So of course it's like completely mind blowing that there's abundance in the world when you live in such messed up conditions. So got to be careful with all that.
Were you able to bring money into the US from Russia, from Soviet Union?
This is actually something I found out much later when I got into Bitcoin this year, the last couple of years. I started asking my questions to my parents about that history. And it turns out that the government let us keep $100 per person when we left because there was essentially a ban on owning any US dollars. So you couldn't own foreign currencies. And you have to have that. And you'll notice that in socialist regimes, they typically lock down their currency because otherwise, if there's a free float against another currency, then, you know, money's leaving the country. It's not a good situation for when you're trying to control prices and things like that. And that's what's going on in the Soviet Union is everything was under tight control.
Wait, so let me understand this. Yeah. Why is it that if you took money out of the country, they would lose control?
So the issue is that like the US, the value of the ruble, the Soviet ruble, which was the currency of the Soviet Union, was set by the government. It wasn't a market rate like we have, you know, in the United States. Like we know a piece of bread costs $5. Well, tomorrow, if, you know, a loaf of bread, if there's more money in the system, then the price of bread will go up, which is, you know, what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. In the Soviet Union, though, they controlled the prices. So they said, okay, you know, we have this, we can print as many rubles as we want, but we're still going to charge you, you know, 1,000 rubles a month for an apartment. And so that created this total disparity of pricing. So for example, like a pair of jeans from America would cost you a month's salary. Okay. Whereas an apartment would cost you almost nothing compared to your salary. So it was a very strange thing where some things were nearly free. Of course, there were shortages of things everywhere. And some things that were, you know, difficult to get were just through the roof expensive. So if you were able to have US dollars, you could buy these goods from other foreign countries, sneak them in, and people were doing that. There was this huge black market around importing goods from the US and selling them underground. And so, you know, they wanted people to use the ruble because that's how they were able to control the prices and, you know, prevent currency from leaking out.
Okay. And so you're there in the Soviet Union. Your dad was doing what?
My dad was a civil engineer, but he was kind of like, he was a civil engineer. He was building, you know, houses and bridges and things like that, but he was working with computers a lot. Okay. So he was kind of an early computer programmer, very basic level.
He saw the future. He said, I see that this is going to be more powerful than this geeky little thing that people see it as.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my dad, I remember actually that's one of the only memories I do have of my childhood. It was going into my dad's computer lab and playing Snake, you know, that Snake game where it was around these. So they had that on the green, it was like a green terminal, monochrome terminal. The computer itself, you know, it was a mainframe. It was just this massive thing taking up the whole floor. And that's what they were doing, they were crunching numbers for engineering projects. And I went in there and I remember playing Snake. So it made a very vivid impression on my mind, but my dad definitely identified computing as a big deal because one of the very first things that he got for me when we moved to America was a computer. It was only, it was within our first year of moving here, and we were, I mean, we were dirt poor. We were living, you know, on nothing. And he kind of saved up money from doing odd side jobs just to get me a computer. So he definitely saw that that was the future.
We're talking about Commodore 64. He helped you also get onto the internet. How old, what year were you on the internet?
93, I was on the internet. So I was, 11 years old.
This is before the Netscape browser. This is before,
way before everything.
Mosaic even.
I mean, I remember going to the store and buying the internet yellow pages. It was a book like 2 inches thick of all the websites on the internet, right?
Like, it's like Google and book form, because that's what you got. Well,
here's all the places you can go. It's completely absurd to talk about that to today's like young people.
Did you download porn from any websites back when you could do it from like the Usenets or something?
You know, like one line at a time.
Right. Yeah. You
know, it would come in like super slow. I mean, my early internet experiences were very interesting. I basically grew up on BBSs, really, before even the internet was bulletin board systems, where you had to dial into that. And like, there was just random text files written by people. It was completely mind blowing that you could interact with people all over the world.
I feel like there are people right now who are doing things in virtual reality that's totally geeky, makes no sense to the rest of us. It's actually just impractical, but it's the future and they're ahead of their time. And once their time hits, they'll be where you were.
Oh, definitely. I have actually, look at this. I've got my Oculus right here. Oh, I can't show it to you. It's plugged in, but I've got my Oculus. I just got it a few weeks ago. And when the lockdown started happening, I realized like things are going to move to VR.
Are you seeing in VR that's making you feel like we're getting closer to virtual reality?
So I think virtual reality has been around for a long time. I actually remember as a kid getting books on how to build VR, you know, things in code and basically like create 3D objects and all that. So the idea of VR has been around for a long time. I think what's been missing is the interactive component where you can actually go and talk to other people. So for that, what we needed was, you know, enough bandwidth on the internet, enough people connected, enough people with devices. And of course, the immersive nature of the new, you know, the Oculus and those kinds of devices that we didn't have even 10 years ago. So what I'm seeing now, and this is actually was spurned by some of the Bitcoin communities that I involve in, they're all in VR now. They're going to, you know, we had a conference that was planned for the summer that was canceled. And so what do? Well, we meet in VR, right? Go into a VR chat room.
How? In a VR chat room?
Yeah, they have this app called AltSpace where you can go in and basically you have an avatar you can design for yourself. And people are hosting panels in there. They have an actual meeting room and they're sitting behind a desk. And the audience is sitting in chairs and you can raise your hand if you want to talk. And it's, you know, it's like you can kind of interact with the people.
Your avatar is sitting there.
Yes, your avatar is sitting there.
When someone's talking, do you hear them in audio form?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, okay.
There's a situation where, so inside of the Oculus, there's audio, you know, you can hear what people are doing.
Earphones built in.
And it's proximity based. So if you're physically close to somebody in that virtual space, you hear them. And if you're really far away, you don't. So there's like ways that they do that kind of thing. You know, started experimenting with it, but I think it's very interesting. And I do think, especially with the lockdown, that more and more conferences are going to start exploring that as a way of just, you know, maintaining that connection that was planned for. But now it's, you know, what are you going to do? It's either Zoom or VR.
My experience with virtual reality was that I would experience these great things, but it kind of sucks to experience it by yourself. It's almost like if you taste a good meal, you want the person sitting at the table with you to taste it. Even if it's bad, you want them to taste it and see how bad it is sometimes, right?
Yep.
And the fact that I'm sitting there on a Facebook-developed virtual reality headset and I can't say, hey, Olivia, this is incredible, come see it, kind of sucks without taking myself out of it. That was one of those frustrations that I had with it.
I agree. I think a lot of it's going to be something where it becomes less, you know, in your face. So once it turns into like glasses or contacts even or something that's a little bit lighter weight, we'll see a lot more adoption. I think right now, you're right, walking around with this giant thing on your head, you look silly. People can't talk to you in the real world. It's not great. But if you're looking to do a virtual conference, it works very well.
Here's one of the things that I'm excited about. I love for exercising at home this app called Zwift. Max Levchin is an investor in it. Didn't he invest did he invest in Reverb?
He did. He invested in Reverb, yep.
Reverb. So he's a founder of PayPal and he invested in this thing that allows you to connect your iPad or computer or phone to a stationary bike. And when you're pedaling on your stationary bike, your character in a virtual world on my iPad, cycles. And so I get to go through virtual New York. I get to go through virtual places that they invented. And I love it. They also have a virtual reality version of this that they haven't released yet that you can just wear the headset and then just go cycling. And I love that there's somebody who's in like South Korea, cycling, and I get to see them. And I would really enjoy being able to do that in virtual reality and also be able to talk to them. Right now, you can just talk to them via text unless you use an outside app. All right, anyway.
Yeah, I think the interaction parts of the virtual reality are still very primitive, and even the games that are like multiplayer aren't really great. I think we're getting there, and that'll be super interesting when that happens.
Right.
But I agree. I mean, I do all my exercise now. Like, I'm stuck in the house, and I put on my VR headset, and I'm boxing, or I'm doing Beat Saber, and I'm getting a good workout. It's really, really good.
Now, all this stuff sounds super geeky. The internet back in the 90s was even geekier.
Oh, it was so
geeky. You couldn't justify it to anybody. Why would you want to go on your computer and order flowers when you could just pick up the phone and order flowers? Why would you want to look this stuff up when it takes so long? Just go to the freaking library, right? Yep.
And there were so many people who are just like, this will never take off. You know, we had that famous Newsweek article 95, which was 2 years after I was on the internet, like Cliff Stoll, who was a very respected technology guy. I mean, I love his books. Cliff Stoll saying like, you know, why would we ever shop on the internet?
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Now.
You know, my mall is selling more in a day than the internet does in a month. And it's like, yeah, I mean,
and
it's 1995.
Like, this is where you are. You got into the Bitcoin world at a time when, to be honest, right now, it doesn't seem to be making much sense.
Right.
But you get into these geeky worlds. You listen to podcasts, you watch, you read, you get obsessed, and then you launch something. By the way, I kind of feel like your turning point was it pronounced Unext? The online university, like University Next, UNext. This
UNext,
was in the late
90s,
an online university. What did you see and learn from working for them?
Yeah, so UNext was my first like true startup. And, you know, I'd been working for a bunch of startups kind of in college. They were on campus companies or startups. But UNext was my first one where it was during the dot-com boom. So this is 1998, 1999. And, you know, it was the stereotypical. I mean, if you look at it in retrospect, it sounds terrible. They raised like $200 million from people like Larry Ellison was involved. I mean, it was completely crazy, right? Build the next. We're going to revolutionize learning. It's going to be online. And the concept was, okay, we're going to take Harvard-level materials, Stanford-level materials, built by Harvard and Stanford professors, and then charge $80,000 for a degree. And it's like, okay, yes, we can definitely charge $80,000 for that. And it turns out, no, nobody wants to pay $80,000 when it's done online. It's a completely different thing. But nonetheless, I had it was a very interesting experience because you had people who are just so passionate about this. And this is what I loved about the startup world is like people went to work. It wasn't work. It was like they were inventing the future. They were working on something exciting. I mean, there's a guy who slept under his desk at UNext. And when I came in the morning, I was like, wow, this guy is very dedicated. And, you know, it took me a while to shake off that idea that you shouldn't probably spend 80 hours a week at work. That's kind of crazy. But when I was, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, it seemed totally rational and cool to do. And so I did it. But that's really where I caught the startup bug and wanted to really feel like I was, you know, at the beginning of something, helping build something that was important and useful for the world, even though it ended up being kind of a failure.
What happened to that? It failed, it closed up. And is that when you and David connected soon after that?
No. UNext was a long time ago. That was my first, you know, it was around 2000. And then after that,
I went. You created Planpus?
Planpus, yeah. So Planpus was So right after UNext, I worked for a company called G2 Switchworks, where I wasn't the co-founder. I was one of the early engineers, probably within the first, 10 engineers there. That was like a ex-Orbitz team. So a bunch of people from Orbitz left to start this airline reservation system. And I helped kind of build that up from the beginning. And later basically started my own startup called Planipus, which was a way to make plans with your friends. It was at the time, it was early... when was this? 2005, 2006, I want to say. It was around the time where Evite was kind of the primary player in the space, and a lot of people were getting frustrated. And so we started building this, and like lo and behold, a year later, there was like 20 other competitors in the space. Everybody saw the same problem. Facebook Events was just getting started. It was a very bad user experience. And we built our own way to make plans, which I actually still think is the best out of all these guys.
Why? What was it that was so good about it?
So it was very democratic. Instead of having this like top down, most event planning platforms have this one person who creates the event and they're like, you know, the event planner, right? For us, it was wiki style. So we had a live chat interface where you could chat with people, which was very, very cool. In 2005, it was very early for that. We had a voting where you could vote on stuff that anybody could propose. And we had the plan itself being totally editable. So anybody could come in there. And it was actually a lot like Google Wave, if you remember that product. And Google Wave was exactly the same product, just more genericized. It was like a thing you could edit live and with other people, and you can vote and, you know, ask questions. So we had all this, and the technology was very cool and was working, and my, you know, my friends loved it. I had like 100 people on there that were just hardcore dedicated fans. But we found ourselves in the middle of the 2008 crisis, and our whole revenue model was built on selling this product to newspaper companies, to media companies, because we said, look, media companies, they have, you know, they have great event listings, but they're completely static. There's no interaction there. So how can we take an event listing at a newspaper and make it into something living so that people can actually go to that event, get excited about it, invite their friends? So we had deals on the table with Chicago Tribune. We had a deal on the table with Cox Networks, which is a huge media company. All of those deals completely died in 2008 as these companies started, you know, hemorrhaging money, restructuring their online departments. A lot of them thought that online was totally dead.
They couldn't afford to pay you.
Correct.
Got it.
Yes. And we were just on the cusp of, like, we had started our, you know, our proof of concept with Chicago Tribune. We were just on the cusp of closing Cox, and all of this hit, and we're like, we have zero customers now. I mean, we have our retail customers, which are just, you know, people doing plans, but we can't really charge them for that. We tried a pay model. It was, you know, like a penny per invitation. It just didn't stick. And we decided to close up shop after 6 years on that startup. It was a very interesting learning experience, though.
How much money did you lose on it?
You know, not too much. I mean, I think we took around 50 grand in friends and family. And a lot of us were working for equity, no salary. It was five people. A lot of us held other startup jobs at the same time. So that included myself. I was also the first engineer on a cloud startup at the same time as doing this thing. So I was getting the bills paid with one startup and then doing another startup at night. And that was pretty taxing. But again, I was early 20s, so I could handle it. And, you know, after 6 years of burning the midnight oil and whatever that expression is, burning the candle at two ends, kind of just felt like we weren't getting anywhere and it was time to close up. So not money, but sweat was lost, blood was lost.
I lost more. I lost $300,000 creating an invitation site similar to you. I noticed that there was a problem with online invitations. For me, as a guy who was organizing events, I just wanted to know who was coming to the event to get a sense of who they were. Maybe even talk to them before, have a way of connecting with them afterwards. And there wasn't a way to do that. And I built it and I just kept getting too deep involved in it before I finally closed it up.
I think knowing when to pivot or when to close is very tricky. And honestly, looking at this in retrospect, I think we had a product market fit and we totally ignored it because we had people using it for planning travel. And that was not our intention. Our intention was like to have quick events, like a night out, you know, let's go for drinks. But if you give people a wiki, like what do people do? They put in complex information in there. So they started putting in flights and travel arrangements. And it was like, great. So we should have pivoted to a travel site. And this is the whole reason why Google Wave died too, because they had no flagship use case. It was like this blank slate. So you get to a site where it's like a wiki in front of you. Okay, well, what are you supposed to do with it?
Yeah.
If you tell them it's for travel planning, okay. And then now people know what to do with it. And now in retrospect, with all the lessons I've learned later, I could say, okay, I could probably have turned that company around and turned it into a travel planning site. But, you know, it is what it is.
Let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor. It's a company called ClickFunnels. I know you haven't used them. And when we talked, you said, I actually don't like creating lots of landing pages, right? Talk about that. And then I don't want to like create this experience where I tell my audience ClickFunnels is perfect for everyone. There's a challenge that you have with creating landing pages or a disagreement that you have with it. Talk about what that is. Do you feel comfortable talking about that, Jan? I think I just put you on the spot.
I don't have a disagreement with it. I think, yeah, absolutely. No, that's great. I love it. I actually don't disagree with landing pages. I like landing pages. I think there's a culture of testing and A/B testing in Silicon Valley, which I fully bought into. And actually, when I came to Reverb and I gave David the book, The Lean Startup, and I said, David, this is our Bible. We need to read The Lean Startup and we're going to measure everything. We're going to A/B test everything and so on. And David was actually very kind of pushed back on that and said, you know, you need to have a strong vision for your product. And sometimes your customers aren't going to tell you what that thing is. And you're not necessarily going to find out from a test what the best product looks like. You need to kind of have an opinion and stick with it and then make it happen. So we always had this kind of back and forth around me wanting to test stuff and him wanting to just move forward with some kind of product vision. And over time, I have to say that I absorbed a lot of his philosophy more so and decided that, you know, I agree, we need to build a strong product. And landing pages, you know, can be a part of that. And I think that's they can be an important part of that, but they need to be backed up with vision, which is like, I believe this is what my customers want. I think a lot of people do landing pages in a more spray and pray kind of way, just create lots and lots of them, do lots and lots of testing, see what sticks. And that could be a valid strategy for a lot of businesses. But certain kinds of businesses where you're building something that's really, really different from what people have experienced, it's not that easy, right? Like, I think if you're building, you know, a new marketing business, then you could just use the same old marketing tricks. You know, let me sell you on 10 reasons why you should buy my product, of how to make your product better, right? But if you're doing something like a marketplace for musicians or a Bitcoin buying site, you can't really rely on those typical, you know, kind of tested strategies. You have to kind of make an opinionated move and see what happens. So I'm into landing pages. I'm just saying, you know, I probably would use, you know, 2 or 3 where somebody would use 100.
So I dismissed ClickFunnels for a long time because I thought we could create these landing pages ourselves. And like you, I'm not somebody who changes them up all the time. And I do love that ClickFunnels gives me the ability to get numbers and A/B test. What I discovered was ClickFunnels was much more than landing pages. It was a way of saying, after somebody signs up, what do you want to do with them? And in the past, what I would do is say, go check your email. Or now that you're done, go listen to the latest episode or whatever. What I discovered is you could be so much more involved than that. You could say, Jan, to someone who just gave you their email address or signed up to your marketplace, say, how about buying this for $1? Buy this for $2 and see if they're willing to buy it, or at the very least plant a seed in their head and let them know that you're selling something and give them a sense of what your business model is so that they're not surprised and feel like you suddenly sprung a price on them. What ClickFunnels does is allows you to sit down and say, I think we need to do that, and then create that like that, and then see whether you like it, whether your audience likes it, see what the impact is. For me, though, let me give you another example of how I use it. We had a sales process on Mixergy that just worked that I'm not looking to mess around with. And still, Michael, our developer who built it, said, I'm going to switch you guys to ClickFunnels. I'm going to redesign our whole sales flow in ClickFunnels. I said, why? He said, occasionally you guys have little additions to the text that you want, and you have to come back to me and ask me to go in as a developer and make the change for you. And then when you see that it doesn't look quite right, you come back to me and you say, edit it, or we get on a call. It's a waste of time. He says, I put it in ClickFunnels. Now you go into the ClickFunnels backend, make a change yourself, see if you like it, see if there's a typo, and then change it yourself. And that ability was priceless for us, because now we don't hesitate to go to him, and he doesn't have to interrupt everything. Like I see right now, he's telling us he's working on the website. He says, please don't make any changes. I get it. I see that he sent the email a few minutes ago. That's fine. But our sales pages can still be changed because they're managed by ClickFunnels. So
I think that's super important. I agree with that. Actually, as a developer myself, you know, that's something I totally agree with. Shortening that cycle around people being able to self-service is totally huge. And I agree with that. Yeah.
Just little things that you wouldn't think of shouldn't go to a developer. I'll give you an example. I decided, you know what? I want to put a face mask on the cover art for my podcast. So I went to Fiverr. I got one created. I'm going to upload it. I don't need to tell Michael, can you please make this adjustment for me? I could just go upload it. And then if I discover, you know what? It's a little bit over the top, or it doesn't feel right, or whatever, I can go back in and change it myself. Giving the user, giving the marketer, giving the person on the team who's responsible for the result, the ability to make the changes that generate the results, is really important. And that's why I use ClickFunnels. There's so many other benefits using ClickFunnels. If you want to go see them, you can go to clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. I would recommend that we're all stuck at home. Use this as an opportunity to test, to see if you could figure out why you're doing what you're doing, how to do things differently, or just understand what ClickFunnels is. Use it for free for 2 weeks, cancel it and move on if you'd like to. I'm hearing a freaking dog in the background. I'm such an anal person that my kid walked in. I'm very loving, very playful with my kids. I'll wrestle them to the ground. I do WWF, not WWE, WWF style wrestling with them. They still see that when I'm working, I get very anal. They opened the door. They saw that I was working. They closed the door and left. I don't even know which kid it was.
Oh, yeah. You need to come over to my house and train my kids then. I don't have an office door. My whole house is an open plan house. It's terrible.
It's driving me nuts. So Olivia opened the window to our bedroom, and now I'm hearing the dog from next door. It drives me freaking nuts. I need everything right. All right, let me close this out by saying, listen, if you're out there and you're trying out ClickFunnels, or want to try it, or think about experimenting, or you've seen that I've done over $1 million with a single funnel from ClickFunnels, you say, what is Andrew doing? spend an hour, go play with this while you're at home, develop yourself, develop your business, and cancel if it doesn't work. Keep building if it does. If you go to clickfunnels.com/Mixergy, you'll get to use it for free. clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. Jan,
that was a good ad, man. I think you've convinced me. I might actually give it a try.
You'll find it's a lot more fun than you expected. I really
I love the idea of self-service. I think, you know, what we've been using in other products, and there's also a challenge to train the non-technical staff to actually use these products and not still come to you and say, hey, you know, because you're the tech guy and you set this up, just do it. There's definitely that. So I'd love to see how ClickFunnels, you know, if it's easy enough that it is very, you know, self-service in that sense.
One of the advantages of using certain companies, Basecamp is really good at this. I know you like 37 Signals. ClickFunnels is really good. I tell my people, if you have a question, go to the chat window and just ask them, and they respond super fast. So now it's not on me. It's ClickFunnels, go figure it out. And I get it. I get an email because it's my email account that we use for ClickFunnels, and I get to see their interaction and I get to see what. All right, let's come back to Reverb. Meanwhile, your co-founder on Reverb sold a company, decided that he was going to buy a music store, right? Why? Am I right? I'm looking at your face. It doesn't look like I've got that right. What did I get wrong?
Well, he had the music store before Reverb, not the other way around.
Yeah. But so actually, after he sold the previous company, right?
Yes, he sold his previous company, David. Yep.
Okay. Sold the previous company, says, I'm going to buy a music store.
Yep.
Dude, why would a guy who's in an online space want to deal with opening up a store, collecting cash, making sure he's in there all day long?
Well, you know, I think my understanding of the story, and maybe it's better you have David on to tell it, but I think that he wanted to have, after this, he had a pretty big exit with Options Express, and I think he wanted to have a lifestyle business originally. But David being David, he's not a lifestyle business kind of guy. So what happened is, you know, he was into guitars, he was into collecting vintage instruments, and he saw this really great store in Chicago, the Chicago Music Exchange, which had an amazing inventory, but it was upside down. It was doing very poorly in sales. And, you know, what he said, okay, you know, I know a little something about selling stuff. Let me just buy this store and see if I can just, you know, make it a lifestyle business. Well, Dave is not a lifestyle business guy. So what he ended up doing was creating a whole online department for that store, which, you know, did amazing content work, lots of great videos and things like that, which became viral in their own right. I mean, they had videos that had like millions of views on YouTube for a retail store, which is insane, right? Like most, especially back, you know, this was 10 years ago, people weren't doing that. So he built this whole online marketing department. He aligned the store's philosophy because the previous owner was very sentimental. He had these guitars, and understandably so. Guitars are a sentimental thing. You have this beautiful, you know, 1957 Les Paul hanging on your store. You want to just look at it all day. You never want to sell it, right? And so this is the fundamental problem in the music market, is the sentimentality prevents people from selling at a lower price than, you know, that they paid for. They kind of treasure the thing. And of course, that creates lockup in the inventory. Inventory doesn't move. So David came in there and said, guys, we got to move this inventory, okay? It's okay if we take a little bit of less margin or even a loss. You got to move stuff. And he was able to grow that store. I don't remember the stats, but it was double-digit growth year over year.
And turned it into a profitable business.
Extremely profitable, yes.
And then the online component became big. And then
it became obvious that there was like, it was so frustrating. Like he was selling on eBay and you know, Amazon was taking 10%, eBay was taking 10%.
So is that the big problem? I was trying to go back and understand his mindset. 2012, I think, is when it launched, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand his mindset. Why would he not be happy enough with selling on eBay and on his own website?
Well, is there anybody who's happiest selling on eBay is the question.
I hate eBay. I don't care if I can. I like saving money. I like all that. I can't freaking deal with eBay.
Right. So answer number one is the customer service is what defines, well, the user experience and customer service, right, defines these products. And eBay's, you know, is horrible. That's just the end of it. You know, when you're calling up eBay support, you're getting somebody offshore, God knows where. They don't know your process. They don't know your product. They don't know what you're doing. And so, like, his insight was not just that the prices were too high, which they were. 10% on a musical instrument is a big problem because that's your entire margin. You can't, like, if you have the 10% fee to eBay, then how are you supposed to make any margin on selling these instruments, especially if they're being resold on the used market and you really have very little margin to work with? So the insight was, we need to lower fees, make it much, you know, close. He always called it closing the bid-ask spread, right? He was an options trader, came from that world and said, the bid-ask on guitars is absurd. The spread is huge, right? What that really means for like the lay person is, people are asking too much and people are wanting to pay too little. So the sale doesn't happen, right? So how do we close the spread? Well, very simple. We make it cheaper to sell the guitar. That allows the seller to come down in price. And we make it easier, right? We make the customer service so good that people feel comfortable in knowing that if they buy an instrument, they don't like it, something happened, the seller screwed them, whatever, they can return it. And Reverb will always be there for you. And that was really the fundamental difference in how Reverb approached customer service from an eBay. I mean, eBay's customer service is really designed to solve technical issues first and foremost. They're not really there to understand your product. With Reverb, when you called in about a guitar, you got somebody who knew guitars. If you called in about a synth, you got somebody who knew their product, who had played with it. They sympathize with you having a broken key, right?
So at first, he was always going to make it easy for people because he knew it was going to be a marketplace like eBay. Mm-hmm. He knew it was going to be for selling more than just his own musical instruments, right? Mm-hmm. He imagined that there were other stores like his who wanted to sell, didn't want to give money to eBay, also wanted or didn't want to give as much money like they did with eBay, and also wanted to make a better experience. Was he
also not just stores, but also individuals, you know, people who had banned equipment lying around for years, which is any musician will tell you, like they have a garage full of junk. I have thousands of dollars of junk lying around that I'm just, you know, too lazy to sell. And that's the fundamental problem is people have all this like liquidity locked up in their equipment. They won't sell it because it's hard. It's a pain in the ass. So it'll just lie around. And that was, you know, the impetus for making Reverb, you know, so easy to use that people wouldn't think twice about selling their gear.
Okay, so I get now why he decided to do this. He then said, I can't build it myself. He wasn't a developer from what I understand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Though he was teaching himself.
He was teaching himself, which is really funny because our very first interview when I flew in and we were even talking about Reverb and he's like, Jan, I'm trying to learn Ruby on Rails. Help me. And I was like, okay. I immediately was like, this is great. This is a CEO who wants to understand how the sausage is made, if you will. Which is really good because it helps him sympathize with what the development team is dealing with when he's asking for features. So, you know, I sat with him and like, I didn't have an interview. I just kind of like sat with him all day and taught him how to do Rails.
but it wasn't a job interview. It was, Jan, help me code this up.
It was a conversation. So I was living in San Francisco at the time. The way that I had found David was he had a job posting online. I emailed him and I didn't know who he was. I said, this sounds great. I want to build a marketplace for musicians. That sounds like the right thing to do. I want to do something positive for the world. Music sounds great. Let me fly back to Chicago. I was living in SF at the time and flew back to Chicago just to have a conversation because, I mean, at an early stage of a startup, it's not like this is not necessarily your typical job interview. So I come into his office and he's there coding and he's like, all right, show me what you're doing here. And that's how we did it, right? We talked, I mean, we obviously talked, you know, high level and strategic as well. But at the end of the day, we just spent like hours, like he was trying to learn how to code and I was helping him. And I think from that, he got the sense of who I was as a person and I got a sense of who he was as a person. And that's what made our partnership so good.
Why did he want a partner? Why didn't he say, hey, Jan, I have experience. I sold a company. I want a CTO. I'll hire you. I'll pay you a salary and I'll give you some equity, but I don't need a partner. Why did he want a co-founder?
I think most businesses want to have a technical co-founder. You want to have somebody that you can rely on for, you know, having real skin in the game. And, you know, especially when you're talking to investors to be able to say that you have somebody who really knows what they're doing. But I think for him, it was, you know, he didn't know who he was hiring. He put out a job post for a developer. I came in and I said, David, you're looking for a developer, but that's not what you're looking for. You're looking for me. I'm going to be your CTO and it's not going to be your typical, you know, you telling me what to do and I code stuff. This is a product that needs to be built. He actually had gone to a development shop at the time and built out a prototype, an early prototype of Reverb. And I looked at it and I said, we can't launch with this. It's not a product. It's a list of features and it's not been thought of as a product. And I think that's when I kind of convinced them that I wanted to be more of that kind of co-founder slash CTO.
What's an example of a problem that you had with it?
Well, an example is the way that he had kind of done it is he looked at eBay and he written out all the features of eBay on a piece of paper and went to his development shop and said, guys, I want to build eBay for musicians. Like, and he had some good ideas about how to make it look nice and skinned and all that. But it had every feature under the sun, including, for example, a support center. A custom built from the ground support center. Now, this is at a time where products like Zendesk exist and, you know, are well thought through and work. And so his support center, you know, that the dev shop had built was obviously not Zendesk level because you know, they had spent 3 months building this thing and they built out an entire eBay in 3 months. So what do you think you're going to get in 3 months trying to build an entire eBay? Well, you get a lot of features and they're all not finished. And, you know, I was very, you mentioned 37 Signals. I was a huge fan of the 37 Signals philosophy. And I love what they say. I don't remember the exact phrase, but it's not like, it's like, don't ship, you know, a half completed product, ship half a product. So cut out features, but make sure the ones you have are really good and they work. So what did I do? I cut out the support system because we're not going to build our own support system. That's insane. And that was a very good
support system. You mean like the help scout, the Zendesk.
Like a help center where people submit tickets and we respond to tickets. You know, Zendesk has so much richness, right? There's macros, there's chat, there's agent management.
Just use what's already there. Use that, right?
I mean, this is like, there's hundreds of employees at Zendesk working on this. We're not going to have hundreds of employees working on our support center product. And that's where, you know, I came in with that strong philosophy of feature cutting and being really focused on our core competency. Another example is we cut out billing. We launched without billing because our billing wasn't complete. And I said, you know, we have 30 days. Before we're gonna launch a promo. We're gonna launch a 30-day list your guitar for free, and we'll figure out billing in 30 days. Again, a very Jason Fried kind of philosophy. You know, do things when they need to be done. Don't do them ahead of time, and launch half a product. And that's what we did. We launched half a product, and we got customers on day one. Right? We could have waited another 3 months to make it perfect, but that would have been time lost.
By the way, I'm hearing the kids jump all over the place. Yeah. Let me yell, Olivia. Olivia, can you please ask them not to jump so much? I'm recording a very important interview. John. Your kids
by
jump
the way,
like this too?
I can't hear your kids, so
oh, you can't.
Whatever,
this mic
I cannot.
I'm usually very proud to have a mic that allows me to listen in on my like what the mic can pick up. This mic that I have at home, I realize the one problem that it has is it doesn't let me hear what you hear. So I think I need to bring the mic from the office into the house.
Yeah, I'm using this Yeti and it's great. Yeti, blue.
And so
Yeti,
when you talk into your mic, does it pick up what you're saying?
Yeah, I can hear myself and I can hear you. I'm listening to my monitoring off the mic.
Yeah, I'm going to need to do that.
Yeah.
All right. I could see why David would want you then as a co-founder. You have strong opinions and he wanted somebody with strong opinions.
Yes,
you
helped he did because his opinions are very strong. He needed a nice somebody who would push back on him once in a while.
Yeah, I don't think people understand how much good founders really want somebody who can argue for their point of view. They don't want to keep coming up with everything themselves, right? We want somebody to say, you're wrong. All right, tell me how you got your first customers.
So we obviously had a little bit of a hack because David had the store. And I say obviously because, you know, why did Reverb succeed where other marketplaces failed? And there was hundreds of marketplaces built in that time, not just for music, but other things too. A lot of them failed to bootstrap because of liquidity. And again, this is where I have to praise David for his insights because he coming from an options trading world, you know, he knew that liquidity is what creates a market. Okay. If you, what does that mean? That means if you come to a site and you try to sell something, somebody's actually going to buy it. And if you try to buy something, there's something for sale, right? If you come to a marketplace site and there's 10 items listed, you're leaving right away. It doesn't even matter if those items are what you want. So we needed a way to have liquidity, not just inventory, but liquidity, meaning somebody was actually going to buy and sell things. And that's where having the guitar shop was a huge deal. So CME essentially acted almost like a market maker would in a traditional stock exchange. There's market makers who basically they help close those bid ask spreads by, you know, buying a little bit, you know, above the price, selling a little bit under what people are asking, closing that spread. So we did the same thing with guitars, right? So for example, you know, somebody would be selling $1,000 guitar. Well, we would haggle it down to $950. You know, we would take it, we'd clean it up, we'd take pictures of it, make it nicer, sell it for $10.50, right? So we kind of help them bring the price down a little bit, still make a profit.
You mean if somebody was selling on Reverb?
Yes, if somebody was selling, the shop would end up, you know, buying
it,
right? And then if the shop also listed all of their equipment on there and would make sales at a slightly lesser margin probably than they would have otherwise in the store. So maybe they would take a 10% margin
in
the store.
Things off.
Maybe they take a 9% on Reverb, but yeah, it would create the sense that Reverb had fair prices, which was very important. And that set a benchmark for new sellers coming on board because they couldn't just jack up their prices. They would have to have fair pricing. And then buyers knew that if, you know, they would get a good price, and if they wanted to resell, they knew that they would have liquidity, meaning as soon as they list their instrument, it would get bought quickly, within that day, sometimes within the hour. Nowadays, I've listed pedals on Reverb, they sell within minutes.
Wow.
And that's what we talk about when we say liquidity. It's like you post a thing and it's gone. You're not sitting there waiting for 10 days on like eBay or something. It's gone immediately.
All right, and you're off to the CME is Chicago Music Exchange. Correct. That's the name of the store. The store really helped a lot in the beginning, but the store didn't own Reverb, did it?
Right. No, it did not. So the store, you know, David was very good with keeping a firewall between those businesses. The store was our customer. They were our first, you know, major customer. And like any major customer, we treated them somewhat special. We gave them, you know, early features and things like that. We had them test stuff for us before we would roll it out to others. But otherwise, they didn't get special treatments in any sense, like, you know, discounts or whatever. They would pay the fees to Reverb.
Did you use the money from the store to fund Reverb?
No. Money, I mean, we had investors. Yeah, we had investors.
Separate.
He actually had some of his own money. Okay. Totally separate, yeah. But the store, like I said, was essentially a partner, like a sister company partner. I don't know how you want to talk about it. They weren't a partner in the business in the sense they had equity. They just helped us, right? We helped them, they helped us, right? They helped us with liquidity, and we helped them by selling more of their gear, which was good for the store as well. So both businesses got a boost from that. And initially, this, you know, optically was definitely an issue because other stores in the area, especially in Chicago, who knew who David was, knew the store, were like, well, you know, this is CME, Reverb is CME's platform. You know, why would we sell on CME's platform? But pretty soon it became obvious to them that we were being very, very fair and very transparent, and we could let anybody compete with CME. You want to compete? Take better pictures, make better prices, and compete.
So the way that you grew was you would go to stores first, mm-hmm. and then get them to list their products. But wait, how did you get users to come in? What were you guys doing to get buyers?
Yeah, it was a two-pronged strategy. One is to get the sellers. We did a lot of door-to-door. Like we had a sales guy calling up stores. We had David calling up stores, and he had relationships with a lot of the people in the area as well. So we kind of covered Chicago first and started expanding after that. But to get buyers, it was a marketing effort. So again, with CME, the store being there, we were able to put stickers, like Reverb stickers, into every instrument that went out. we were also able to use Reverb itself as a, essentially, like, we ran our own shop. So there's a shop on Reverb called Reverb Merch, where we would sell our own merchandise. We also had a shop that would, you know, buy and sell pedals. So that was good for our users. So like if somebody listed a pedal and it wasn't selling, Reverb store would pick it up and, you know, clean it up, fix it, take better pictures, resell it. And that created this churn and liquidity on the site. Like, as we come back to it, like, liquidity is the most important thing. So Reverb was creating that notion that people could really buy and sell stuff. And with every purchase that went out, we put in stickers and promotional materials and coupons. We ran sales, you know, all the typical stuff that you would do as a retail store, we did by partnering with other stores. So we would go to one of our sellers and say, we'll do a nice video for you. We'll profile your shop. We'll put your gear on sale, and you go out to your customers and tell them to come to Reverb and buy that stuff. And
why would they send them to Reverb instead of to their own store, to their own website?
Because first of all, a lot of shops are not equipped for, you know, high volume online sales. Like, their website is not great. It's not tracking visitors properly. They're using, you know, 1990s antiquated systems, websites that were built God knows when. So giving their users an experience that was better for shopping meant they sold more gear. So yes, they could have taken a bigger margin by having them come to their own website, but if their website was converting 1% of users, then it was useless. And, you know, for us, the conversion rates were much higher, and we were able to get people in the door and out the door quickly. We also provided all the customer service, right? So it wasn't like we were just, you know, taking their margin for nothing. We handled all the sales. We made sure people were happy, right? Like, we're doing all of
that. But weren't they also potentially losing customers by sending them to Reverb? And
not really. It's because we had branded homepages for shops on Reverb. So you'd go to like reverb.com/someshop. They had their logo. It had their information about their shop. It had their phone number. Somebody could call them directly. Okay. We were very careful about making sure that shops felt like they still had a home and we weren't just stealing their business. Because at the end of the day,
I always think everyone else is a developer or techie like me, because I always do some hunting on the URL to see what else is there. I'm always constantly.
For sure. And we were making sure that people had good homepages, because a lot of shops, they have really bad homepages. I mean, honestly, there's
a lot
stuff that's awful. Like, I don't know who designed it.
Right.
They were proud of their Reverb homepages, and they would share them because, you know, at the end of the day, we did so much for them that we just created all this volume for them. And so what if the margin was less? The volume was so much more that it made up for it.
All right, let me take a moment. I want to come back to what the sales reached at the end. I've got it here on paper, but I think if you told our producer in private that you should say it or not, if you change your
mind.
I mean,
these numbers are all public, so I don't think I'm saying anything.
Oh, really? How much? What was the sales at the, not the sale price, but the revenue at the end?
Oh, well, so I don't know if that's public. I can tell you what was, I mean, I know that in 2018, they published an article and they were saying that they were at 500, 600 million annual sales. Yeah. So that much is public. I don't know if they
published
2019
numbers. But
that's
the sales on the platform. That's not their cut of the sales, right? Okay, correct. Let me take a moment to talk about my second sponsor. I'm going to tell you actually about one of my ugly websites in this ad for HostGator, which is a hosting platform. It's andrewandolivia.com. I was hesitating, should I say it or not? If you go to andrewandolivia.com, what you'll see is a WordPress website with a photo of me and Olivia holding up a sign of what we love. We had this like thing on a Sunday where we said, oh, you're going to it right now, aren't you? You tell me what you see. We were living in DC and we were in love. And so we said, let's go and ask people what they love. And I love DC. I love living there. And so we went to the stores, like a fun afternoon project. We got a bunch of,
I do see it.
You see it? We got a bunch of like giant paper, got some markers, and we asked strangers, what do you love? Write it down. And then let us take a picture and we'll put it on our website. And we got like 30 different people to tell us the stuff that they loved. It was so fascinating what they were excited about. And unfortunately, well, what I did was I took a picture and I posted it. And my plan was to put one a day up on the site. And then we kind of forgot about the site and never published more than just a few days. And I don't even know what happened to those old photos, but the website is up. The reason I'm telling you about that is because it was such a like fun idea for an afternoon. And then it died within a couple of days after that. And it seems like what a waste, what an embarrassment. But I'll tell you something, building little projects like that is what gave me the confidence to create Mixergy. What gave me the confidence when I finally did have a good idea to say, oh, I could just put that up in a day and we'll see what happens with it. And that's what I'm going to urge everyone in this ad for HostGator to do. Go sign up for HostGator by using HostGator.com/Mixergy. Use that baby plan, as they call it, to have unlimited domain hosting. And every time you come up with a crazy idea, just go and launch it and see what happens. Allow it to shut down. Get yourself comfortable creating these things, creating these businesses, playing around, especially in a world. Look at this. Jan is nodding so much. I love it. This is why I like having video
on. In startups, you have to create and fail, create and fail, create and fail, right? That's the formula.
Do it with yourself. Do it with your kids. And then when you finally hit on that idea, boom, it could take off. And the thing that I love about HostGator is, yes, using that baby plan, you have unlimited domains. But they also have inexpensive pricing for really dependable service that's been around for years. And at this point, when you sign up for a hosting company, you don't want them to keep billing you a lot of money month after month for something that you're going to keep forever. Go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. They'll take their already low prices. They'll lower it even further. And they'll make sure that you're happy with it, giving you tech support, unlimited email addresses for your business, unmetered business. Now I'm actually reading features. What the hell? Let me tell you guys something. The one feature you should care about is two features. One, it freaking works. And number two, they have a 45-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not happy with their already low prices, they'll give you back your money. Go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. Go create your own ugly site and then keep building from there. All right. Reverb, why did you leave?
So this is a complicated story. Why I left. So I'm a startup entrepreneur for a long time. I've been very comfortable in, teams of 5, 10, 15, 25. In 2018, Reverb was 150 employees. I'd grown this thing, from me and David, the two of us, to 200 to 150 people, 500 million in sales. And I had started kind of looking at Bitcoin in 2016 and researching it. And a lot of people will tell you this. There's a certain rabbit hole effect that happens where once you start learning about Bitcoin, you either fall down the rabbit hole or you don't. But if you fall down the rabbit hole, there's no end to it. And I started reading everything from economics to finance to understanding how markets work to the technology and the distributed systems that power it and the game theory. And I just like became enamored with the idea of Bitcoin. And this was in 2016. So by the time 2018 rolled around, I was at a point where I was listening to Bitcoin related podcasts or videos or reading books 3 to 4 hours a day. It was essentially a second job. And at the point where Reverb was 150 employees, I felt like my job had been done. I got the thing started. I bootstrapped it. I got it working. It was doing great. Hundreds of millions of dollars of sales per year. And I felt like my skills are in that early stage startup. I wanted to do something else. I didn't know what it was going to be, but I wanted to do some kind of startup. And so in 2018, I mean, I knew it was going to be Bitcoin related. I left Reverb and decided I was going to kind of explore the space, learn more, see what the projects look like, see where the money is going, where it's not going, where are the developers, like what are people working on? And, you know, I pretty quickly fell into consulting gigs because it's, I think 2 weeks after I left Reverb, a buddy of mine called me up and said, "Hey, I've got a friend, he's working on something Bitcoin related. Like, can you talk to him?" And I said, "Okay." Went and talked to the guy. Turns out they're doing a startup in the blockchain, you know, space, if you will. And I basically started consulting for Bitcoin and blockchain related companies for, you know, from 2018, probably for about a year. And at the end of that year, I felt very comfortable. I understood what was going on. I understood the space. I decided that Bitcoin was the only thing that mattered in the whole quote unquote cryptocurrency space, and wrote a book. I decided that, like, I still didn't know what I was going to do as a startup. I felt like a lot of ideas in Bitcoin were too early. And this is, you know, part of the problem is that the hype in the media is so vastly bigger than the actual reality of like who has any Bitcoin. Because by our estimates, it's about 0.5% of the world. We're basically at the point where in 1995, where Cliff Stoll writes that the internet's not going to go anywhere, while the penetration of the internet is 0.5% of the world. So yeah, it looks like it's dead on arrival. Just like Bitcoin looks like, quote unquote, dead on arrival, 0.5% of the world has any, but the price is, you know, 10,000x what it was a few years ago. So long story short, a lot of noise in the space. I write a book called Inventing Bitcoin. And that gets me into a lot of Bitcoin circles. I start talking to folks who have been around for longer, trying to understand where the opportunities are. And again, it comes back to nobody has any Bitcoin. And so I say, okay, well, if nobody has any Bitcoin, what we need to be building is a Bitcoin on-ramp. And you brought up the question earlier in the interview, do we need another place to buy Bitcoin?
Yeah, it feels like everyone, the Cash App now, right?
Yes. Cash App is wonderful, yes.
They let you buy Bitcoin. There are a bunch of different companies.
Robinhood lets you buy Bitcoin.
Okay, I didn't know
Cash
that.
Cash App lets you buy Bitcoin. Pretty soon E-Trade will let you buy Bitcoin. Schwab, Ameritrade,
so
I mean, you name it.
Dude,
everybody's going to let you buy Bitcoin.
Who needs you?
So who needs us? Well, there's a couple answers to that question. One is how many places sell stocks? How many places sell gold, right? There are literally thousands, if not tens of thousands of businesses that do both of those things. And the reason is because people have a very personal relationship with those kinds of places, and they buy gold from their local gold dealer, or they buy a gold ETF from Schwab, right? They buy different kinds of products from different places. With what we're doing, we feel like a lot of the early businesses that were built in the Bitcoin space circa 2013 and so on have kind of lost their way. An example would be Coinbase. So Coinbase was an early on-ramp to Bitcoin. Today, Coinbase is more of a trading platform. So that means if I want my mom to buy some Bitcoin, I send her there, she's hit with 30 other coins. Most of them have zero fundamental value. They're used by professional traders to fleece retail investors. And now I'm sending my people and my friends and my family to places that are essentially going to get them wrecked, as we say. They're going to lose their money because they're going to buy some random thing that they're not supposed to be buying. They're going to try to trade it. We don't want that. We don't believe that's what Bitcoin is for. We believe Bitcoin is a freedom money. It's a way to save money in a way that is, you know, inflation proof. It is proof. It is seizure proof. If you need to leave your country, like I did with the Soviet Union, that's what Bitcoin is for. And so we want everybody to have a little bit, and we make it very easy to save a little bit at a time with the simplest possible user experience. I mean, you will not find any site that is simpler than us for buying Bitcoin. And even Cash App. I love Cash App, but you buy stocks on Cash App. You have a cash card. There's 5,000 other things that Cash App does.
Stock now too.
Yeah, they're doing stocks. You can buy a fraction of a stock now on Cash App. Free promo
so
for Cash
App.
So
what you're saying is, you said, look, there are lots of different places people can buy, but the problem is that it's still too difficult because each one of these different
yes.
platforms has a different interest, a different thing that they do to actually make money. And Bitcoin, I feel like Bitcoin is almost the way that they bring people in the door.
Yes, that's exactly right. They actually make a lot of money on trading, and they encourage trading, right? They encourage people to trade Bitcoin against other cryptocurrencies. And look, if you're not a day trader of stocks, if you don't know how stock options work, you 100% certainly should not be in the cryptocurrency trading space. You have no business there. It is so much more vicious because the people there are professional traders, and the vast majority of people trading crypto are not professionals, and they're just getting ripped off.
Okay, so that's what you created. How did you get...
And we also coupled it with a nice Sorry, I wanted to say the other part of the business is that we've brought in a lot of the podcasters and authors of the space. I mean, obviously myself, I'm an author, but our head of education, Brady Swenson, he's the host of the Citizen Bitcoin podcast. It's a bunch of people like that who have experience educating people, because we don't think it's enough to just throw somebody into the deep end and say, hey, go buy this number, it's going up or it's going down. But actually educate them on what they bought, why they bought it, and why this matters.
You mean on an individual level, or are you saying...
both like in content Reverb. Production is...
Sorry, you go ahead.
Yeah, we produce a lot of content, written content. We have a weekly show called Swan Signal Live, where we record interviews with prominent people in Bitcoin, which we also turn into a podcast. So it's written content, it's video content, it's podcasts. It's also individual attention. So if somebody emails us or has a support question, we have a chat, we'll give them that hands-on treatment and walk them through any issues they might have.
Last year, you guys started operations, right? What month, 2019?
Yeah. I mean, officially, we launched in March. We've been around for a bit longer. So the company kind of pivoted. We were originally called Give Bitcoin, which was a gifting product. And we still have that product, but we decided that the much bigger play here is really to go after on-ramping. In other words, getting people onto Bitcoin themselves rather than being gifted Bitcoin. And that's what Swan is about. It's about, you know, getting yourself into a recurring purchasing plan, save for Bitcoin, just like you save for your house or your car.
Don't you think you made a mistake by adding Bitcoin to the name? Because now you're locked into Bitcoin. You could decide in the future that you need to make it a little easier for people to do some other part of cryptocurrency.
I don't believe that. And
you just believe in Bitcoin that much.
Yes. And here's the reason. The reason is I've spent 4 years studying it. Okay. Now, somebody who's new to Bitcoin, the first thing they'll say is, why wouldn't I buy some other coin? It's faster, it's cheaper, whatever. After 4 years of studying, you know, all of the subject matter that is required to understand Bitcoin, which does include things as esoteric as like Austrian economics and, you know, how power works and how energy.
I get it. But then what about another coin that comes out in the future?
All these things are really important.
What about something that, no, you don't,
that's
you're
not
just
what matters,
in the Bitcoin world. Did you lose a lot of money on Bitcoin?
And the reason is because that's not how money, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Did you lose a lot of money on Bitcoin? You did, didn't you?
No, not really. I mean, what do you mean by lose? I haven't sold it.
Yeah, but you lost value. The time that you got into it, Bitcoin was higher than it is now.
That's not true. I actually started buying Bitcoin in 2016 at a price of, you know, $600. But even before that, I bought some in 2011, which at 30, which I sold at 2. So I have made my mistakes for sure.
Okay.
But I no longer, I don't trade Bitcoin anymore. I've realized that it's more about long-term savings. So.
And that's the whole idea behind Swan. Swan Bitcoin is long-term. Buy a few bucks every, like we said earlier, every week, every month.
$5
just
every week, $25
bucks
every week. Yeah. Most of our users are buying $50 to $100 a week. That's kind of the common amount.
March 2020 is when the world got hit by coronavirus. It was obviously there before, but that's when
we
things got really bad.
On the eve of coronavirus. Yeah, it was crazy.
Wait, did you launch last year?
No, Swan was launched officially on March 23rd, I want to say.
Yeah, that was 2020. How did Corona influence your sales of Bitcoin?
I mean, we're a new company in general, so it's hard to say what our sales would have been like if Corona wasn't here. It's very tough. I mean, it's obviously early days. But our initial numbers look very good. We were expecting that people were going to save about $100 a month, and they're really more on $200 a month on average. So people are buying more than we thought.
How many people bought?
We have just a couple hundred users right now. But we're closing in on so remember, this is an annual plan. So we're already at about $1 million annually of Bitcoin that we're selling.
Because when somebody buys with you, they're not just buying one time, they're committing to buying.
Right, they're signing up for essentially a recurring purchase plan. And we expect most people to finish out a year, if not more. Most people coming into Bitcoin that are properly educated are here for the next 25 years, not
for
1 year.
Is it all subscription? I can't just buy once?
It is all subscription. That was one. Okay. That was actually a product decision that I pushed for with co-founder Corey Clipson, who is a great guy also. And I said, we have to have recurring out the door because that's what we're selling. We're selling the idea that Bitcoin is a savings vehicle. So you don't buy savings one time. You don't put away savings one time. You do them, you know, every week, every month, every paycheck. That's what we're selling people. We're selling a new behavior, and that's a big challenge for us.
What else was I going to say? Why should I trust you with my bank account information?
Well, I mean, bank accounts have a lot of protection for you. At the end of the day, it's ACH. You have 60 days to claw back your ACH if you really want to call your bank and do that.
You tell me I could buy Bitcoin from you, and then if the price goes down, I claw back because it's ACH?
Well, so we do have protections against that. We do usually hold it, you know, for 10 to 15 days. And if, you know, if that's for smaller amounts, if you're buying more than $2,500 a month, then you actually get into a 60-day lockup window, which we require you to hold that $2,500 with us, you know, for the full ACH clearance window. So you don't defraud us. And yeah, we're taking a little bit of risk on the smaller accounts, but in order to buy with us, you're giving us your ID, you know, you're opening a trust account essentially. So you're uploading your ID, your full credentials, everything. We're going to know who you are. I'm going to hunt you down. Don't rip us off.
Why should I trust you to not lose my Bitcoin? We keep seeing examples of companies that have security vulnerability. In fact, forget about big companies. Even on a private level, I've heard from people who have Bitcoin in their LinkedIn profile. I guess this was a couple of years ago. They would have their Bitcoin stolen because people would start to hack into their Gmail account in one case. Right.
And stuff. Yeah. So with Bitcoin, there is a certain level of danger from theft, obviously, because there's no recourse from a theft. It's just like cash, right? If somebody breaks into your house and steals $100, like they're gone. So same thing with Bitcoin. However, so there's two things that we would say on that. One is we do use a regulated and licensed Nevada chartered trust company. They're called Prime Trust. They custody billions of dollars for bigger companies besides ourselves. And all of their Bitcoin is stored in what is called cold storage, which means it's not actually online. It's not like nobody can hack into it and find it. It's very, very secure, but you shouldn't trust that. You should always withdraw your Bitcoin, right? So that's what, you know, as Bitcoiners, our educational agenda is to teach people about how to withdraw their Bitcoin to their own wallet. And we're going to be partnering with other companies that do a great job of providing wallets that are actually in your control where nobody else is in charge. And so we have an auto withdrawal feature. So let's say you buy, you know, $50 of Bitcoin, you can withdraw every time you reach a certain threshold. So if you reach $100,
it'll go
straight
now?
To your wallet. You could do that now.
Got it.
All right. The withdrawals are live now. The auto withdrawals are going to be live probably in a few days.
Okay. And you want me to do that?
Yes, we absolutely want you to do that. Because again, with Bitcoin, the whole point is for you to have full sovereignty over the money. It's not in anybody's control. We do recognize that for a lot of new users, it's tough to do that. And that's why we do store it for them until the time that they're ready to take charge of it. But that's always the intention, is to teach them about how to do that and have them take it off the platform. We don't make money on the storage of, you know, we don't like lend it out. We don't do any of that stuff.
I got a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. When I interviewed the founder of Stash, which lets you buy partial shares of major companies, I said, can I just set this up for my kids? And he said, yeah. So one day at dinner, I said to my kids, I interviewed this guy. I'm going to just buy you shares. What do you want to buy shares of? Well, they love Beyond Meat. So, okay, we got Beyond Meat. Nice. Unfortunately, they got hammered on that. It was spent $20 on that. It's now 11.
Bought the top. Well, everything's hammered. So
everything got hammered.
For the most part.
Except for Amazon. But at least in the morning when they say, what are you looking at? And I say, I'm just checking out how the market's doing. Why is it doing this way when the world seems to be going that way? At least then they can ask me, so how is Amazon doing for us? And if I give them the overall share price for Amazon, it's too confusing. If I tell them, you put $20 in as of this morning, it's worth $24.48 or something. And they understand, right? And they also can connect the fact that we're getting more stuff delivered from Amazon. Everyone's getting more stuff delivered from Amazon.
I'm going to do that with my kids. I love that idea.
It's such an easy thing to do. So with Swan, how many hundreds of dollars do I need? I actually know the answer to this. It seems like I could do this with Swan. How much money? What's the minimum that I could set it up for?
I mean, $5 a week $5 per anything. So you want to do $5 a month? If you really just want to do $5, you know, go for it.
Okay. So we just set them up. Wire the money in. Or actually, you guys.
Well, no, you don't wire it. So it automatically. Yeah.
ACH
automatically
comes withdrawn. Any issues with you guys? And I could just tell my bank, I dispute it. These guys ripped me off. It's fake, right? And I also have a couple of bank accounts. So I could use a bank account that I that I'm comfortable doing this.
Yeah,
with.
Totally. You can connect any account you want and you put a smaller amount of money. But ACA, the whole point of the legacy banking system is that it's actually very good for protection, for consumer protection, which Bitcoin isn't. It's not designed for that. It's very important to understand that Bitcoin is actually the money. It's not really a banking system. So you can build stuff on top of it to do those things where somebody will hold the funds for you and escrow and, you know, do all that. But just like gold or cash, that's what Bitcoin is. We're not expecting, you know, if somebody steals a bar of gold, you can't hunt them down in any fashion, right? Same thing here.
All right. I do love your freaking design. Now, the stylus of my iPad, this Apple Pencil, dropped down on something and it just brought up this beautiful page. It says save, I guess in this case, $50 worth of Bitcoin every week using my account. Just so beautifully designed. I know what it dropped down on. It dropped down on the image of the iPhone on the screen.
Nice. Yeah. So it's actually a German designer. We're a fully distributed team, which is also another interesting thing for, you know, being Corona proof is we were already all working from home. We're already all fully geo distributed. We have got people here. We got the co-founder in California.
It's Jorn Roeder. Am I right?
Jorn Roeder from Germany was, you know, contacted us, said, I love what you guys are doing. I want to be your designer. I said, great. You know, now we have a German designer. We've got Brady, who's out, I believe, in Kansas. You know, we have people all over the world. And people really love our business. I mean, it's very early, obviously, but as far as the Bitcoin in crowd, which, you know, there's really probably a couple hundred people, if you look on Twitter, who are really, really the Bitcoin influencers, and they all have their own followings. And they love our business because what we're doing is it's good for Bitcoin. We're not even letting people sell it. It's literally like a way to convert US dollars, which are being inflated at an insane rate. And oh my God, do not let the government tell you it's 2%. It's definitely not 2%. Look at,
I mean, the inflation is more than 2%. Can I sell Bitcoin through Swan?
You cannot. If you want to sell it, if you really want to sell it, you can find an exchange and do that. But most of our users are not there to sell. They're there to accumulate for the long term. I mean, we're talking about children and grandchildren here. We're talking about multi-generational accumulation of freedom
money.
Very
opinionated on this. I like that.
Very opinionated.
All right. The website is swanbitcoin.com for anyone who wants to go check it out. They're very good with communication. Like you can, yes, you can sign up to their podcast and all that. But I mean, like, I think I sent a couple of customer support messages just to see what would happen.
Oh, and that was you, huh?
Not today. But I definitely try to do that from time to time. I also wanted to see like how active your people were. Like Brady Swenson is on there online a bunch. Talking sometimes about stuff that nobody responds to, but he doesn't care. He's out there.
Yep.
He's your head of education.
Yeah. All yeah. Right. So we don't call it marketing. Really, it's marketing, but we don't call it marketing because we really do think it's education. We found that when people learn more about Bitcoin, they tend to buy more of it. It's just that simple. Listen to a very good podcast, explain something really well to you. You're like, oh, that makes sense. I need to buy more Bitcoin because obviously the price is way too low. At $6,000. This is way too low. So, you know, it's that simple. Educate people, they buy more.
All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this interview. I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first, if you are building a landing page or any kind of funnel that takes a stranger and turns them into a customer, go check out clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. Play with it. Really, this is your opportunity at night when, I don't know what, when you have some quiet time to just sit and say, let me see if I could figure this out. You will see why this leads to more sales. I did not want to use them. I railed against them. And then somebody on our team signed me up. And before I knew it, I ended up doing over $1 million with one funnel. I didn't even think that was true. But someone on my team said, Andrew, you definitely would have with one funnel. They submitted my my story to ClickFunnels. And ClickFunnels sent me this big gold record with two commas on it. I got into the two comma club, get it two commas in a number of million because I did $1 million with one funnel. It is that easy. Well, no, it's not that easy. It obviously took us some work, but it's easy.
You probably have to have a good product too, and not just the funnel.
Yes.
It helps to have a product.
So take it over to clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. And if you want to build a website for anything like I did to just putz around the internet, go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. That way, when your right idea comes to you, you will be able to launch it as fast as you can launch a Google Doc. It's hostgator.com/Mixergy. And finally, since this podcast is over, this interview is over, if you're looking for something with a little bit more tactical information in it, I've got a podcast to recommend to you. It's by the founder of ClickFunnels, and it's called Marketing Secrets. That guy loves the word secrets. Marketing Secrets. Check it in whatever podcast app you're listening to me on. All right, Jan, thank you so much for being here. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. Bye-bye.
Thank you.